the volume.
The Colin Cowherd Podcast brought to you by FanDuel. It's never been easier to play fantasy on FanDuel. Whether you love basketball, golf, soccer, or any fantasy sport, there is a contest for every fan. FanDuel, more ways to win. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Friday morning podcast. First of all, Chip Kelly is going to talk NFL, Eagles, his Oregon days, how close did he come to taking the Florida job. He's Nick Saban, Pete Carroll. We're talking everything with him, then Chad Millman. Really excited. One of the smartest guys I've ever met in football, Chip Kelly, joins us today. But as always, it's Friday. It's time for fake questions and real answers. Here we go. Dear Colin, was there a time when stats were more important than titles? When did that change and who changed it? Well, I think titles always mattered, but I think Michael Jordan really pierced through sports like nobody ever had. He was not only the best player, he was the most glamorous, he was the coolest, he was the best looking, he was the best dressed. And so Bill Russell won almost twice as many titles, but he wasn't as dynamic offensively or as cool. Jerry West was called Mr. Clutch. He went 1-for-8 in the finals. And then Jordan came around. I mean, think about that with Jerry West. 1-for-8, he's Mr. Clutch. It's not just that Michael was the best basketball player in the world. It was the way he did it. He had the first big shoe campaign. It created sort of this force field around him. He failed at baseball. He got a divorce. There was gambling. He was awful with the Wizards. It didn't matter. You couldn't pierce it. And so I think once Michael Jordan now is so popular, he was the most popular NBA player, according to polls, 20 years after he retired, is that we just look at it differently now, is that Michael is so popular that we judge everything on perfection in basketball. By the way, we don't in football. Joe Montana's 4-for-4. Tom Brady's got 3 Super Bowl losses. We don't care. The minute he had 5 Super Bowls, he's better. It wouldn't matter if LeBron James won 7 titles. He's not as cool. His game doesn't have the offensive appeal. Jordan changed all the rules for basketball and perhaps sports. There's never been an athlete who was the best, the coolest, the best looking, the best dressed, the most glamorous, and the most popular. And don't kid yourself, LeBron will never be as popular as Michael Jordan. Dear Colin, you can be very critical of players. What happens when you meet somebody you criticize face to face? Is it civil or do you throw down? Well, it's happened a few times. Most athletes are pretty passive when you meet them because they know you go on the air the next day. So why tick me off? Why be confrontational? But the truth is, I'm not that critical. Yeah, I've been rough on Baker Mayfield. But if you took everything I ever said, it's probably a 50-50 split. I got the Browns winning the division this year and getting to the AFC Championship. I've been tough on Russell Westbrook. I've been tough on Aaron Rodgers. I'm just tougher than the local media. But the truth is, if you took everything I've ever said about Westbrook, Aaron, and Mayfield, it's 50-50. It's just 90-10 in their favor from local media. So I don't see myself as unruly and unwieldy in terms of criticism. I think I'm fair. By the way, 10 years before anybody else talked about it, we said there were questions about Aaron Rodgers' body language, his eye rolling, and his leadership. It's now that everybody else talks about it. I'd rather be first when it comes to those judgments because I watch the games, I watch body language. I just don't think I'm that unfair. Dear Colin, do you see impressions that people do of you? And what do you think they get right or wrong? I don't see a lot of them. There's a kid at Barstool, Joey something, that I think's funny. It's the first one I ever saw and I laughed at. I think he's got down kind of my style, where I often repeat stuff to accentuate points. I think he's very good, actually, and very funny. I always, as a kid, I did impressions growing up. I did Howard Cosell. I did Keith Jackson. I did Marv Albert. I did Vin Scully. And they were all the broadcasters I liked. So I take that stuff as a compliment. If somebody's impersonating you, you have a style. I'm good with that. Colin, you're a coastal liberal, so you can't see that the media is liberal. Open your eyes. No, I have largely acknowledged the media is liberal. In fact, on social issues, I lean left on virtually everything. The difference is, unlike the rest of the media, I admit it. Socially, I'm left. Fiscally, I'm moderate, sometimes right, but mostly right in the middle. I view myself as an independent. Where the media gets in trouble is when they don't realize they're a business and they're not authentic with their audience. Listen, the NBA ratings have gone down 35% in 2 years. The basketball didn't get worse. The players didn't get worse. What happened? They went all in on politics. The Oscar ratings the last 2 years have tanked. They've lost 45 to 50% of their audience. The movies didn't necessarily get worse. The actors weren't more pompous or self-absorbed. They went all in on politics. Just admit it. There's a big chunk of people who don't want politics with their movies, their award ceremonies, or their sports. I occasionally talk Trump, mostly tweaked him because I think he's bizarre and a fire hose of narcissism. He's gone now. I'm really honest about my politics and about the media. They lean left. What worries me is how few do. They don't. 70% of newspaper people in studies done for years are Democrats. Of course, it sometimes shades their views. Just be upfront about it. Colin, a lot of people are selling their companies. I just read a story where The Athletic is trying to be sold. What is your take? My take is I didn't build the volume to be sold. I've built it to work at it forever. If somebody wants to spend a lot of money and buy it, I'll consider it, but I'm not retiring. In terms of The Athletic, I thought they made one big mistake when they started. Anytime you have a business that is behind a paywall, it's a subscription service, it is really hard to drive people through that wall. Instead of hiring media critics and hockey writers, I would have gone out and found the 10 best podcasters I could and the 10 best columnists I could to drive people through a paywall. They did the opposite. They got beat reporters. They were slow on podcasts. They tried to make it a volume play with journalism. There's simply too much on the market right now. Free, blogs, the internet. You don't have to pay for it to get. Too much of their information is already duplicated in non-paywall businesses. So I think it's destined to never sell for the amount The Athletic wants it to. The minute you go paywall, Howard Stern was the first to break through it. SiriusXM exists because of Howard and the NFL. People are willing to pay a monthly fee for both. 90% of SiriusXM channels have virtually no audience. Years ago, I read a study or a report that 90% of albums, 90% of all albums had fewer than 10 copies sold. 10% of all albums make all the business. So good luck to The Athletic. But from day one, I didn't buy into their business plan, even though I rooted for them. All right, let's bring on Chip Kelly, UCLA head coach. Big year for him. Big year for him. He's got to win. Now, at the end of last year, they were a much better team. And we'll get into the transfer portal. They have used that very smartly this offseason. They got four, maybe five starters out of the transfer portal. We're going to talk Eagles. We're going to talk UCLA, SEC, Nick Saban, Pete Carroll. Let's bring on Chip Kelly. So it's funny, Chip, when I think of you, I do think certain coaches fit certain areas. New Hampshire fits for you. Eugene fits for you. LA, Manhattan Beach fits for you. And then I think Philadelphia, I don't know. I mean, you won. What's funny, I looked it up today. You won. Buddy Ryan won 55% of his games. Andy Reid, 58. You won 55. So did Peterson. Y'all got whacked. That's Philadelphia. It's angry. And I think of Philadelphia and I think, was there ever a moment, maybe before you took the job or during it, you thought, these people, they're angry a lot.
Now, honestly, I loved it. And I love the fans. I think anywhere where you can be somewhere where your fans are passionate, I'll take that 100% of the time over someone that isn't passionate. And it's, they live and breathe it. They love sports. And it's, I love the Mike Schmidt quote. You have to understand is it's the only place where you can enjoy victory on Sunday and then be depressed reading about it on Monday. You know, something to that effect where it's never good enough. But I think as coaches, it's never good enough for us either. All my mind goes to is what's our next game? Who are we playing next? You know, we're done. Like, I'm not into the celebration and let's go crazy. I think that town thinks the same way. You know, when it's I enjoyed it. I really did. And I know some people, you know, from the outside, if you're not inside it, I think you can kind of bash it just like any place does. But I love the fans of Philadelphia. I thought they were awesome.
Now, UCLA is different. It's historically a basketball school. Mm-hmm. The football stadium's down the road from the campus. It's Los Angeles. There's option. A bad day of weather is 68 and partly cloudy. Yeah. Does that frustrate you, or have you come to terms with that it's more casual?
I think because you're always internally motivated. So it's not, it doesn't really, to me, it doesn't matter where I am. It matters who you get an opportunity to be around. The unique thing for me about UCLA was the kids that chose to go to school here are intrinsically motivated. They understand that it's going to be challenging academically, and you want to be around kids like that. You want to be at a place where they want to be successful in everything that they do. And I talked to David Shaw about what his experience at Stanford is like. And it's there are schools that are different, the UCLAs, the Stanfords, the Notre Dames, the Northwesterns. But when you look at them, whether it's Mike Bray or Pat Fitzgerald or David, is that, you know, you want to be around guys that want to be challenged on a daily basis. And if you look at some of the classes that our players take, you understand that they understand that challenge too. And if you don't have to deal with some of the things that other guys have to deal with. You know, you got kids that are, you don't have to worry about kids going to class because they chose here because they want to go to class. You know, so some of the things that I think some college coaches are more worried about, we don't have to worry about. So to me, it was about the players. And then it was about a school that's committed to excellence. You know, they've won 118 national championships in various sports. But the last one they won in football was in 1954. So I looked at it as a challenge, you know, and a challenge that at this point in time in my career, I was excited to be a part of.
It's almost like you were before your time in the NFL. Do you look at some of the pollination kind of college football into the NFL now and think, you know, maybe I was about 8 years ahead of it?
You know, and I've said this before, but if you weren't in the room with Amos Alonzo Stagg and Newt Rockne when they invented this game, then you stole it from somebody else. You know, so Dutch Myers, who was the head coach of TCU in the 50s, was running empty, no backs, you know, and no one talks about it. You know, everybody talks about when we got to Oregon and we're running up tempo and no huddle. Well, Sam Weish was doing that in the NFL with the Cincinnati Bengals, you know, and Marv Levy was doing it with the Buffalo Bills and the K-Gun, you know, so it's cyclical. I think it's just trying to figure out what applies. The game itself, I think at the next level has turned into more of a spread out game because people have realized the athletes are so good. We better get them in space. You know, the days of Buddy Ryan was ahead of his game because he ran the 46 defense. Everybody was in two back and you couldn't run the ball, you know, and they had those monsters up front with Singletary behind them, and they played press man on your two receivers and you couldn't get off. So how do you combat those defenses that are all in the box is we got to spread people out. And that's where I think the college spread out game has kind of moved to the professional level. And there are some guys, you know, Andy Reid's a great example. You know, you look what Sean Payton's doing with two quarterbacks. And you got a Hall of Fame quarterback and Drew Brees that he takes out of the game sometimes so Taysom Hill can play. You know, it's I think everybody's still evolving. And that's the fun part. But I think there's a lot of similarities. It used to be really different where college, I think 10, 12 years ago was one way and the NFL was different. But I really think there's a lot of carryover from both now.
The Colin Cowherd Podcast, proud to be presented by FanDuel. Never played FanDuel Fantasy before? Great. FanDuel is offering users the chance to play free. No deposit required at all. Plus, for those folks who want a deposit, FanDuel is offering up to a $500 bonus instantly when you make your first deposit with their 20% deposit match. Why do you play on FanDuel? First of all, FanDuel Fantasy, easy to use app. Take 5 seconds. Pick a new team every game. Compete for top cash payout. For new users, FanDuel is offering up to a $500 bonus instantly when you make your first deposit with their 20% deposit match. So just go to FanDuel.com/Cowherd. That pays the bills for us. FanDuel.com/Cowherd for more info. FanDuel.com/Cowherd. They know we sent you. FanDuel, more ways to win. When you sped the tempo up collegiately, I remember Nick Saban one time told me privately. He said, I think I can say it now. Yeah. We were up in Bristol, and he said, you know, my concern about this, he goes, the officials, the game is so fast. He goes, in the Auburn game, and he didn't want to say this because Auburn beat him. He goes, there were 11 missed calls on both sides. Mm-hmm. He goes, the officials were just not in place. He goes, the athletes will figure out the speed. So will the coaches. I'm not sure 59-year-old officials can. When you were speeding up the tempo, and there were guys like Saban that said, I'm not sure football's meant to be played this fast. Did you mm-hmm. see that as just kind of proprietary? I'm protecting my program. Or were there concerns out there that were legit?
No, I think it was proprietary. You know, the two biggest, and they're two great coaches at the time were Nick Saban and Brett Bielema. But look at what they ran offensively, you know. And I would have been the same way. Like, well, why can't we play fast? Because I think you should play fast. Well, we played fast as an equalizer. So how do we tire out an SC defensive lineman? Because we're not going to be able to line up one-on-one and knock him off the ball. So everybody comes with it with a little bit jaded. And you got to give Nick credit. And that's why he may be the greatest to ever do this game is he has evolved. And now he does it all. You know, the things he didn't like, he's doing. You know, he was a big guy, didn't like RPOs. They may be the best in the country at RPOs, you know. And so when you look at it, that's what makes him such a great coach because he's constantly evolving. But I think a lot of that when you're worried, you know, we all want, if you want to win an argument, how do I get as much fodder on one side to the other? You know, let's play to the referees. We can get the referees on our side and they'll make the game slow down a little bit. But Nick's always looking for an advantage and he's really done it. You look at what they've done offensively and where they were, you know, you could argue that they're wide receiver you now, which 10 years ago, you wouldn't have said that. But now you look at the wideouts that they've turned out in the last couple of years and you're like, holy smokes. They're doing such a good job with it because I think he's evolved with it. But yeah, I can see him saying that because at that time it was a run the ball guy and let's play great defense. Now it's almost, you got to get a stop or two in each half. And then see if you can continue rolling on offense, you know, then you're good to go, you know, and that's really what the game has turned into.
The reason I think Saban's the best college coach I've ever seen is not simply because of winning, mm-hmm. but what hurt Mack Brown, Bobby Bowden, Pete Carroll, and Urban in Florida, that it's transient at the coaching level. Mm-hmm. Pete kept losing coordinator after coordinator. And I remember him telling me once in his office, I'm recruiting coaches as often as I'm recruiting defensive ends.
Yep.
Saban has lost really high-end assistants and just keeps reloading.
Yeah.
I find that fascinating. I don't – maybe he's so connected. I mean, just take me to that, the difficulty in losing coaches and having to find good ones that are often better than the previous one.
I don't think he gets enough credit for that, you know, and I think he developed the analyst off the field role that no one really had and then turned it into a real, almost like a landing spot. You know, when you look at the, just who's been an analyst at Alabama, it's a who's who. You know, it's Sark, it's Mike Loxley, it's Butch Jones, it's Mike Stoops. The list goes on and on. So he almost has a bullpen of guys so that when a guy leaves, he may have the guy already on staff. So the transition for him is the offense and defense and terminology doesn't change. He's not bringing in a new guy that brings in his offense or his defense. He's still running it the way he wants to run it. He did it with Kiff. Lane started off as an analyst, and then he promoted Lane when he lost guys. So he's got a unique system, and I think that unlike anybody else, you know, we only have four analysts and they're low paying jobs and they're all real entry level jobs. You know, we don't have what they have, but he set that up because I think he was really conscious of that, is that you're going to lose coaches. So what do I do to combat that? You know, he's got an answer for everything that I think you can look at and say, hey, this is what the next big hurdle is going to be. Well, all right, how do I handle that? And I think you hit it right on. Is his ability to replace coaches has been phenomenal, you know, and almost like the next guy comes in is better than the guy that left, and the guy that left was really good.
I remember when I really thought you broke through a certain threshold when you caught Pete Carroll flat-footed in Eugene. And that was a good SC team, and they did not have an answer. And I always wanted to ask you, they were literally dominating recruiting on the West Coast. If there were 20 great players, they were getting 14 to 16. Mm-hmm. And the week before that game, you're playing up-tempo, and Pete goes up there, and I swear to God, there was a moment I thought he was going to grab a white towel and just start waving it. Did you see the game before it happened? Did you sense they just weren't ready for the pace of play you and the Ducks delivered?
I don't know if they weren't ready, because, I mean, he's such a good coach, but I think it's one of those things, you know, the unique thing of college football that I think everybody truly, and hopefully we can get back to it, is when you can get it rolling at home and it's that atmosphere, you know, everybody, it's such an emotional game at the college level, that when you can, we hit a couple plays early and then all of a sudden it took off and then the crowd was behind us and it was Halloween night. We were wearing black uniforms and, you know, the stars were aligned. I don't know if it was much as that we cut them flat footed, but, you know, our players made plays that day and it wasn't we out-schemed them or anything like that. It's just our players just kind of played. And I think the unique thing, and I know you know about it, is playing up there in Eugene is a real tough place to play, you know, and it's no matter what it is, you know, you listen to even the basketball, you go back to the UCLA days when they used to go up there and play in the old basketball arena in MacArthur Court, it was always a difficult atmosphere. So it's always difficult to go play games. And for some reason, USC at the time with Pete, he had gone up and lost to Oregon State the year before. You know, they struggled in the state of Oregon on the road, and we kind of knew that, and we put that up as much as we could with our guys. So it was one of those days where kind of you look back and say, hey, you know, that was a pretty good night.
It's interesting. You've said you love passion and you love the environment. Florida, Jeremy Foley, was very interested in you. Mm-hmm. Well, their passion is crazy in the SEC. That's the loudest stadium, along with Autzen, I've ever been in. It is Gainesville and Autzen. Yeah. How strongly did you consider Florida and the SEC?
I considered them all. And it was Scott Strickland at the time, who I think is one of the top athletic directors in the country. You know, I had a couple opportunities, and I just felt that this was the right time for myself and my wife when we decided where we wanted to go. And a lot of, again, I think to me, the challenge, you know, is it quote unquote a basketball school? All right, well then let's see if we can change that. And let's do it the right way with really good kids. To me, it was more of maybe this was more of a challenge. And that's what really got my blood boiling.
I've heard, you know, I tell people this all the time. On my staff, I'll say, listen, man, challenges are opportunities. And the transfer portal came out and I heard a lot of old coaches, you know, bitching about it. Mm-hmm. And it was funny. I called a couple of coaches and I said, isn't it basically a better version of junior college? Mm-hmm. You already know they can play at the D1 level. Mm-hmm. It's never really an academic issue. It's they miss home and they didn't get a play at Ohio State. So they want to come back to UCLA. I look at the transfer portal and I think, oh, Chip Kelly's got a third place.
Yeah.
There's junior college, there's high school, there's transfer mm-hmm. portal. You guys have benefited from it greatly. Why do you think you've benefited so well?
I think we've embraced it. You can be that old guy that, you know, stands out on his porch and yells at the clouds and get mad about every little thing, or you can say this is going to happen. And if this is going to happen, how can we use it to our advantage? To us, the first kid I recruited from the transfer portal was Wilton Spade, who had left Michigan. And he was just such a mature, when you talk to him about what was important to him, it was about getting into grad school, what his degree was going to be in grad school, and what was our football system. And when we talked about an official visit, he said, Coach, I don't need to come and get wined and dined. He's like, I think when he went to, before, he goes, I went to Michigan and I walked up to my room and there was a cookie with my name on it. It was the coolest thing in the world. I'm not going to make my decision based on food. I'm going to make my decision on what's it like academically and what that degree will mean for me when I'm done playing football. And then what type of system do I fit into? And I remember walking away because he was the first kid we ever recruited as a transfer, because I was a bit old school. If they want to transfer and they don't want to be there, you know, are they not loyal? But it's just a different world now. And it's the kids we've gotten have all been extremely mature. They've been great leaders. They're really focused on what they want to do. They also have a shorter time. So they're not worried about screwballing around. Like, hey, I got a year here. What am I going to do academically, and how am I going to set myself up, and what am I going to do football wise to make sure that I have an opportunity to play after this? And it's, I love the maturity of the kids, and the kids we've gotten have been fantastic, and we're really excited about it. I don't think you make a living, but I think you still build through the high school kids, and that's where the development comes. But I think with the NFL background we have, it's just like the free agency supplements your draft, you know, and what do we have? You know, if we have a hole, can we fill it here? Is there a corner out there, or is there a wideout out there, or is whatever that we can fill? Because we really like the high school kid, but we don't know if he's going to be able to play right away. But we know this kid can play right away because he has played right away. We've actually seen it demonstrated. So I think you go to both, you know, and you have to evolve. And I think the teams that are doing well with the transfer portal kids are the guys that, you know, we do extensive homework. You know, I call the head coach. You know, we have a great running back right now, Britton Brown from Duke. Well, I called David Cutcliffe. And I know Cut really well, and Cut gave me the whole load and loved him, and what a great kid, and this is a good fit. And, you know, so there's a lot of times, I think really your due diligence and how you do your homework, you make no bones about, like, what are we about? Like, if you're coming here and you're going to grad school, it's hard, and you got to go to work, and you got to want to get a grad degree. Like, you're not coming here to major in eligibility. But then we get kids that don't want to major in eligibility. They really care about the degree. So then I don't have to worry about them off the field and in their maturity to them. So we love the transfer portal, and we really embraced it.
What's harder, recruiting high school kids and projecting if they can work at college, or drafting college kids and projecting if they work in the pros?
I don't know which one's harder, but I think they're both extremely hard. Because the track record will tell you that. You know, you look at, what is it, 50% of first-round draft picks don't make it, you know,
50, and then you go back to 46% don't make it.
Yeah. Don't make it, you know, and I always said that they have oodles of money, and how do you figure that out? But I think being able to project what people are like, the big thing with the NFL, when they get money, you know, for some guys, their goal is, I want to make it to the NFL. You did. Now what? You know, what do you do with that? And the same thing at the college level. I saw a thing that half of the five-star quarterbacks have transferred in the last 5 years. Anybody that was a five-star, you know, how many are on their second or third schools because the first school they picked didn't pan out. So I think the hit rate's probably the same, but it's the million-dollar question, and who's the best at evaluating. I think where you're really good is, do you know, and not get caught up in what people think on the outside, but do you know what fits in on your team and how that works? And the guys that are the best at it don't really pay attention to the outside things, and just worry about, is this guy a good fit for the type of system we run? And will he be a good fit in our locker room? Will he be a good fit in our school? Will he be a good fit in our pro organization, whichever one it is? And I think the fit part and the people that can project the fit are the best at it.
You know, it's interesting. I have a theory, and I'll throw my theory that concerns me. I grew up as a Pac-12 football fan. I would call it sort of the health and wellness or green plate concern out west, is that the economy in Silicon Valley is so great, it has spread to California, Los Angeles, Salt Lake, Portland, Eugene, Seattle, and Boulder. And these places now, home prices are doubling. Mm-hmm. And what happens when people make money? They eat better. They vacation more. And I said this about 7-8 years ago. I started noticing West Coast high school kids, offensive linemen, shrink. And I said, God, these college coaches, these kids are 268 pounds. You have to project how they play at 305. Mm-hmm. A Southern kid, a high school kid in the South or Midwest or Houston, he's 308. And you only have to project if he adds 10 pounds. And I said, Are we too healthy out west? Mom goes vegan, dad supports mom, the plates are greener, the kid gets smaller. Now, this just may be horseshit, but I follow recruiting my whole life, Chip. Yeah. I've been getting magazines since I was like 18. Mm-hmm. And it does, I do ask my friends, I said, why are the offensive linemen like 268 to 272 out here? Is my theory nonsense, or is there something, is there a challenge out there that you have to project on size, and there are just fewer big kids out here?
There's something to it, I think. I mean, maybe we can study it. We can get an economist or Freakonomics to look at that. I know there's a, when you look at just from a, if you study it from an analytics standpoint, the dearth of defensive linemen come from the Southeast, you know, and there's a bunch of them, you know, and it's, when you look at per capita in high schools, and it's, you know, Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, there, that's just the sheer numbers, you know, and that's part of what you deal with. But there's also been some really good players on the West Coast. I don't think it's ever a black and white where it's all this or all that. I think there's something in there, you know, and part of that is, if that is an issue, then what are you doing nutritionally to supplement that? So if you're saying we're projecting this kid from 265 pound kid to being a 305 pound kid, well, what's your nutrition program like at your school? And is that a feasible thing for those kids to do? You know, and I think they all come in all shapes and sizes, and where you find them and how you find them. You know, you look at Penei Sewell, who's a West Coast guy, you know, and is the first guy off the board. And then you look at Rashawn Slater, who wasn't really a highly recruited kid out of high school, and he's the second one off the board. You know, when I was in Philadelphia in our first year, we drafted Lane Johnson. He was a quarterback in high school. He went to junior college quarterback, and then was a tight, and then went to Oklahoma as a tight end. Then he played some defense, and then went over offense, and he's an all-pro offensive tackle now.
Cam Akers is a running back for the Rams, and I was telling Les Snead, I said, the fact that he quarterbacked in high school, he didn't have 5,000 carries in high school, like a Zeke Elliott or Saquon Barkley, so he's not as beat up. He's got a longer tarmac.
No question. And that developmental piece, you know, the other tackle we had when I was in Philadelphia, Jason Peters, was a tight end in college. You know, he's potentially a Hall of Fame offensive tackle that was a tight end, that was an undrafted free agent that Jim McNally found, I think, and they signed him and developed him, and he turned into one of the best tackles to ever play. So they come from all over. I just think you need to search long and hard. For us, we're looking at frames all the time, and what can the body hold? You know, I think sometimes that's an issue where the kid is, what you get at 260, is he 4 years later, he's going to be 260, or is what you get at 260 going to be, you know, be 300? You know, Kirk Ferentz is known for, and he's got a great reputation in college football for finding those 220-pound guys somewhere in Iowa, and then all of a sudden they become a first-round draft because they're 300 pounds. You know, who can – where is it? But that person had to have a frame that could put that much weight on. So I think that's – it's really how you look at it and develop it. It's a key component to what you're looking at. But I think you're right. There is something to, and I know just from the analytics part of it, where most of the defensive linemen come in. Most defensive linemen are coming from the Southeast.
Yeah. I talked to Urban Meyer once. He was working at Fox, and I said, we were talking about USC, and I think he considered it. And, you know, I told him my theory about the green plates. And he goes, you know, we didn't go west very often for a defensive lineman at Ohio State. He goes, we love their quarterbacks, receivers, and corners. So he thought it was interesting. But I remember him saying, he goes, I would probably recruit Texas pretty hard if I was a West Coast. I mean, you've recruited Texas very well at Oregon, I recall.
Yeah, we knew where to go and where to hit. Texas is just such a good state, and they're so well coached. And they have year-round football. So one of the things I think people really enjoyed about, from a recruiting standpoint, what if you recruited Texas, is that you went there in the spring and you actually watched them practice football. You know, in some states in this country, they don't play football in the springtime. So you never get a chance to, you're projecting, you know, what was the kid like? Well, he looked really good walking down the hall. You know, that was the only evaluation you could get on the kid during the spring recruiting period. But I would argue, if you're here on the West Coast, there's 80% of our roster when we were at Oregon was from California, you know, so you really got to make sure you take care of the home base. Now, we would always, you can supplement your class, but you got to have a kind of a home recruiting base and know where the most of your players are coming from.
I used to always argue the quality of life coaching college is much higher than it is at the NFL level, but now you have to recruit year round. I could make an argument now the NFL coaches have a little bit of an off season. You guys don't. Mm-hmm. Are you a fan of this dual signing period? Because I think it hurts the quality of life for you guys.
It's not really quality of life, but it's, I think 90% of the kids sign in December. And the kids who don't, I think if you told them they had to sign in December and then you left the window open, like if you don't want to sign in December, you don't have to, but we're not having a second signing date. Like I go back to a few good men. Why the two orders? That's what they said all the time in the movie. Why the two orders? Why the two signing dates? There's one signing date. Just sign it. And if they don't want to sign, just leave it open from December on signing day till close it in February. In the month of January, it's open. If they want to sign, they can sign. But why to have second signing date? I don't know. I think, you know, sometimes there's unintended consequences. But when you look at the numbers, and they've gone up and up every year when they started the first signing date. I think it was 90% of the kids signed at the first signing date this year. And it was during COVID and no one could take official visits and still didn't affect them. They committed and signed and were ready to go. So I hope at one point in time, that's one thing that can change. Because most people, if you're signing 90% of your kids in December, when you're going back out on the road in January, you're looking at underclassmen or you're saving spots for transfers. So the coaches have already moved forward on it. I think it's really, hopefully it's just an administrative thing. At some point in time, they'll take that part away, the second one away.
NFL college career, greatest football player you've ever coached, the single greatest player you've ever coached.
That's a great question. I'd say, you know, from a talent standpoint, Jason Peters in Philadelphia was as good a tackle that's ever played the game. Personal favorite was Darren Sproles. You know, you meet Darren Sproles and you're like, wow, like that's an NFL player. And then watch him for 5 minutes in practice, Colin. And you're like, wow, like that's what's so special. We were in a walkthrough. He took a handoff and it was OTA rules and you can't do anything. There's so many rules in the offseason, what you can do and can't do. And he sprinted. And I was like, Darren, it's walkthrough. You can't sprint. And he was like, I haven't lasted this long in the NFL by not sprinting, so I'm gonna sprint. I said, all right, everybody else walk. Darren's gonna run full speed and everybody just watched him. I don't know anybody that's ever practiced as hard as he's ever practiced. And when you look at his career, the guy played 13 years in the National Football League. And he's as tough as they come. He's as gracious as they come. He's as competitive as they come. And he could do it all. He could return. He could carry the football. He could catch the ball coming out of the backfield. And he was just an amazing guy to be around on a daily basis. But, you know, those two guys kind of jump out just because of, you know, obviously Jason, just because of how athletic a guy that size. And I mean, he's really a Hall of Fame type tackle, you know, to be around someone. I remember watching him move the first time and I was like, holy smokes, I can't believe how athletic this guy is, you know. And there was a ton of others, you know, coaching Marcus, you know, a good guy won the Heisman Trophy and Marcus Mariota and what an amazing athlete and how quick he processed things, you know, the ability to run, how accurate he was, his ability to process things, you know, he was a special player. There was a bunch of really good players that I had an opportunity to coach.
Chip, it's great seeing you. Enjoy your bike rides, your lovely bride. You got a great life. I'm rooting for you and I appreciate this, man.
All right, buddy. Time.
All right. You know what, man? Chip Kelly is one of those guys that when you listen to him, very pragmatic, super smart. The Philadelphia situation was crazy. He goes 10-6, 10-6 with quarterbacks who are kind of like at the end of their career or have been replaced somewhere, and Philadelphia hated him. Why? Philadelphia is a market about tradition. He's contrarian. He didn't do it the way they'd seen it. And Philadelphia, it should be noted, has fired every coach. Andy Reid had the best winning percentage at 58. Rich Kotite the worst at 54. And they all got fired. When you get hired to coach the Eagles, Nick Sirianni, good luck. You will be out in 2 years, three max. And with that, we bring in my buddy Chad Millman, Chief Content Officer, Action Network, which just sold this past week for $240 million, which is a lot of money according to my sources. That is a shit ton of money. So Millman, you're not a big spender guy. I don't see you as a Lambo guy or a third home guy or a private jet guy. Did you go out and buy something though?
You know, it's it's funny. I like to think of it as not $240 million, but a quarter of a billion dollars. Just because, you know, it sounds better. And it's funny, you're right. I am not a big spender at all. I live in central Connecticut in West Hartford, you know, in the same town you used to live before you hightailed it out for the West Coast. And like we as this was happening, of course, we think about, you know, we're going to come into some cash. What do we want to do with it? My wife and I, she's from New York. We lived in the city for a long time. We thought, do we get an apartment in the city? And at the end of the day, we haven't done anything and we're not planning on doing anything. The truth is, all of a sudden, life becomes practical again. And we have a son going to college and we have another son starting high school. And it sounds so boring to say, but we don't know where the fuck we're going to live in 4 years. So I'm not buying a place in the city. I'm not buying a place on the beach if I'm not going to want to live near either of those things, because I might want to move into your beach house. I might want to move into your backyard in 4 years. So for now, we're still using gift cards when we order from Avert, our best restaurant in West Hartford.
Well, I think I told you this on the phone the other day. I've made a good living for a long time. It's never been about what I can buy. It's about what I don't have to do anymore, which is if I wanted to, I could have a yard guy 3 times a week. I could have somebody come in 4 days a week and clean the house. I've found that money isn't about what you buy. It's about what you don't have to do anymore. You can just concentrate in your family and your business. It's an efficiency changer.
It's interesting you say it like that. And obviously, it's a weird thing to talk about because you're so lucky to be in this position, to have an exit like this. And I'm lucky to have been at the business since the beginning, you know, leaving ESPN to help launch it. And so to accumulate value in the business, right? And so we think a lot about it and what it would mean to us and all those kinds of things. And I'm going to put it in perspective in two different ways because we were having this conversation with friends the other day. It really just means, and it sounds obnoxious to say this, it just means if we're going to go on vacation, I'm less stressed about where we're staying and what we're spending on vacation.
Yeah.
Which is, by the way, is a massive, massive luxury to have in life. And even when I was having I was not sort of lucky enough to be getting some kind of windfall from this and making a very nice salary, you would still think about it, right? We'd look at houses to rent, we'd look at hotels, and I'd think, can I stay there with points? Do I want to spend that much on the house? If I stay 2 blocks further from the beach, it's, you know, a couple grand less. I go to this town, it's less than this town, that kind of thing. The other thing that's really interesting that you say, just thinking about the business, we knew this deal was coming and it's been going on for a couple of months. And we were fortunate enough as a business that there was a process where there were a lot of people involved who were interested in acquiring the business. And when it came down to it, and the company that bought us, Better Collective, we, this past weekend, we knew the deal was closing. And I kind of wondered when I woke up on Monday morning, how was I going to feel? I left ESPN in September of 2017. That's 3.5 years ago. Every day since that day, I have been thinking about how are we positioning this business for an exit? What does the landscape look like? What does the competition look like? What do we need to be doing to put ourselves in a position to be attractive, whether it's a media company, an operator, a company like Better Collective that is an affiliate business based in Europe that bought us? Whatever the case may be, who's doing what? Where are the deals happening? Who do we need to be talking to? How am I, as an executive at the company, thinking strategically about this and communicating that with our CEO, our COO, our head of finance, whoever it was? And when that was ending, I wondered, when I wake up on Monday morning, am I going to think, I want out? I don't want to do this anymore. My energy is spent. And what I found was I woke up on Monday morning and was incredibly energized and incredibly motivated. because to your point about the personal finance, but also for the business, I was unburdened from having to think about some of those things. And when I thought strategically, I only had to think about how am I going to grow this business for this new company that owns us that, and I've de-risked a lot of the urgency about selling the business.
Yeah. I mean, listen, you're either a competitive person or you're not. I mean, part of me leaving ESPN is I won. I make four times as much. I'm off at noon. I live in a better city. My ratings are through the roof. That's part of it. That when you leave a company, part of it is competing. You're a competitive person. I'm a competitive person. So congrats on winning. Now, this is interesting. The whole Aaron Rodgers thing is off the board for a lot of people. As of right now, does the Action Network have him staying or leaving Green Bay?
We're only judging it based on what we are seeing in the markets. And in the markets, you are seeing the Broncos that went from 70-1 to 12-1 in some places based on the reports that were out there. Now, you're right. In a lot of places, you can't bet on the Packers. You can't bet on their season win totals. This is fascinating because as far as I can tell, the Packers have all the leverage, right? They don't have to trade him. They can keep a guy who's one of the most talented quarterbacks in NFL history and have him play for them because he's under contract. And the truth is, whoever they trade him to, the value is going to be in future value. So if they trade him to the Broncos are going to give the Packers first round picks, but those first round picks are going to be based on how well the Broncos perform with Aaron Rodgers as their quarterback. They could win the Super Bowl. And then all of a sudden, a first round pick is the 32nd pick in the first round. So it's very interesting how any team and how the Packers could even try to negotiate what a trade looks like. One other thing here, and I was talking to my kid about this today. If you look back, you would have thought when Aaron Rodgers won the Super Bowl in 2010, I think it was, that he was going to go on a stretch. He's such a pinpoint, precise passer. He's so good in the pocket. He's so smart. It turns out he may have been lucky to win that because in the end, he didn't have a very good head coach for the majority of his career. His team did not support him with offensive weapons. He is very lucky to have gotten that one, let alone thinking, oh, he should have gotten more and maybe losing in NFC title games. He's just lucky to have gotten a title.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. If he goes to Denver, if I was Green Bay, I would want a receiver because my takeaway is picks are fine. But in the end, Jordan Love needs more ammo or I'm going to look horrific in this deal. And you don't want to, I said it today on the air, you don't want to have a Carmelo to the Knicks deal where Denver is forced to trade him to the one team he'll go to. And then by the time Melo gets there, he's a chandelier in a house that has no furniture. And it's like if Aaron demands West Coast, that absolutely disincentivizes Green Bay to give anything away. Aaron should be open to Miami, open to the Giants. This whole thing about Jeopardy, actress, move West, that doesn't help Aaron Rodgers, in my opinion, whatsoever.
No. Do you know what's interesting? And you mentioned the assets. When Deshaun Watson, before the reports came out about the sexual harassment and his market, disintegrated. That is the word. Words are not my thing. Thank you for that. You're an author.
Money and cash is your thing.
I completely lost it. When that was happening, someone asked me, what would you trade from the Chicago Bears for Deshaun Watson? I thought to myself, I would trade Khalil Mack and I would trade my next 8 first round draft picks. Because at the end of the day, an all-star quarterback who can be generational as Deshaun Watson has proven to be is worth all of that because that's a sure thing. You've got it. Every other pick you get, you don't know what you're getting. So really, to me, it does come down to the assets that the Packers could get.
Now, the draft is over. I thought the Chargers really solved their offensive line issues. I thought the Browns in the offseason solved their secondary issues. I thought Kansas City rebuilt their offensive line. I thought Miami had the best pure draft. First five picks could all start. Any move, I mean, God, I don't look at the Chargers the same today as I did 2 months ago. Did the draft change any of the odds in your opinion?
It did change it for, in my opinion, it changed it for the Chargers because I think like I already had them to win the Super Bowl. I had them at like, I can't remember, 50-1 maybe. But if you look at the board, it's all the same teams. The Browns moved up a little bit. The Browns were in the 20-1 range. Now they're in the 16-1 range. Mm-hmm. I mentioned the Broncos. The Broncos have moved up tremendously. They were at 70-1. Now they're at 22-1. But the rest of them, you know, I'm looking at the Chargers are at about 32-1. So there's a little bit of movement there. The Dolphins are about 30-1. That hasn't been that big of a move because there was already a lot of attention being paid to them. There hasn't been massive movement outside of what you were talking about for the Broncos because of Aaron Rodgers.
When you look at the draft and free agency and coaching, generally, does the market change? What is the theory on, I'm going to wait for camp, I'm going to wait for the exhibition season? How do I get the best number on a future? Is it come now or later?
You kind of missed it. It really happens. It just does. It's now. From the past, say, 2 months before free agency is when you really want to start thinking about this, when you want to start playing the market, when you want to start looking at rosters, looking at openings, looking who's going to be a free agent, where will a big move happen? Could there be a quarterback type move with like Tom Brady in Tampa Bay? The next best time will be once the season begins and you've started seeing some kind of potential on the field with certain teams. Maybe the Bengals came out and lost their opening game, but they were playing the Chiefs and they didn't get blown out by the Chiefs. They played pretty well. Those first 4 weeks for an NFL season are when so many decisions get made and you start to learn so much about a team. If you look back over the years, take the Falcons, for example, the Falcons over the years would always start off really hot and they'd be 6-0, 7-0, you know, 7-1. And then they'd fade in the second half of the year, but they'd still be a playoff team. By the time they get to the playoffs, you could look back at their games and say, okay, early in the year, they beat three or four teams that had high expectations, but turned out to be not very good. Then they struggled against some teams that people had low expectations, turned out to be very good. And we started to see who they really were. You get this transitive property feeling about how teams are playing. So if you can watch a lot of games during the year and through that first 4 weeks, start to get a sense of who's undervalued by how they do on the field, if they struggled or if they played good teams really well, and look at their schedule and map that out, and you've talked about this, then you can find some value. But this range between draft and the start of the season, you're not going to get much.
By the way, we know Denver's odds go up if Aaron goes there. What would happen to Green Bay's win total if he leaves? Where is it at now? It's about 10.5. Where would it go with Jordan Love?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I can't see. Look, Aaron Rodgers, all-world quarterback, MVP. This team's winning, 13 games, 14 games a year? That's what you can expect, especially the past two seasons, obviously. What do you know about Jordan Love? And what do you know about the rest of this team other than Aaron Rodgers? If Jordan Love is the quarterback, I'm taking this thing down to 8 minimum.
Chad Millman, he just sold his company. He's humble, but he literally right now could turn off his internet provider and never talk to America again and swim in Cristal. It's an amazing thing.
That is so not true.
It's so true. It's obnoxious, but I could not be happier for you, honestly.
Thank you. You have been tremendously supportive. I will say this, both at ESPN, and then when I was thinking about making this move to leave ESPN, you were unbelievably supportive and all in on taking as big a risk as possible. And I appreciate the support and the enthusiasm.
You know you're rich when you could have a really bad meth habit and still be rich 10 years later. That's where Millman's at.
I'm just going to go try it and see what happens.
See you, buddy.
See you, brother. I'll talk to you later.
We, of course, are hoping Chad Millman never, ever has a meth habit. I just suggested he could overcome it financially. Of course, we would never, ever hope that happens. We are good people here. Follow us at The Volume Sports on Twitter, Instagram. Rate, review, subscribe. Thanks so much. We're having fun here. Join us.